Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons, all, to a special collaboration episode. Recently, myself and Alec Avdakov of the Life and Times of Frederick the Great podcast sat down to talk about Frederick the Great and his invasion of Silesia in December 1740. Now, I love doing these collaboration episodes, talking about other history podcasters, about areas of history they're really interested in is, of course, right up my street. And if you know me, you know that I'm a big fan of Freddy as well. We've covered his exploits to this period in our Poland Is Not Yet Lost Patreon series, which of course you should check out, although it should be set on a biased source when it comes to that. And I would love to do more of these collaboration episodes, it's just the actual lack of time. And thankfully, Alec has been very patient with arranging all these things. So yeah, make sure and check out his podcast. He's only 21 years old, as far as I'm aware, so he's a full 10 years younger than me, which is kind of disgusting considering the fact that he knows more about Freddy than really any 21-year-old should. And his podcast, as you might suspect, looks at Frederick the Great, but it doesn't just look at the man himself, it also looks at his life and times, which gives him a great chance to go all around Europe during this fascinating time. And Frederick the Great ruled from 1740 to 1786, so you really have a period of history that can be seen as the kind of prelude to the French Revolution, and Alec likes to think of his podcast in that sense, and I think it's fair enough. Alec's scholarly attention to detail and his clear passion for the subject really shines through in his show. So do check his show out if you're in any way interested in Frederick the Great, and you should be. And give him support anyway, because independent podcasters are making history thrive with every new episode they release. And I also love doing collaborations like these because it's a great way to give a platform to podcasters you may not have heard of. Although I'm only able to enjoy a small portion of the 8 billion people. We recently passed 8 billion people in this world. Oh, by the way, on a other side note, listen to my discussion with Dr. Jennifer Shuba about demographics that we released a few months ago, because that milestone seems like a good enough reason to do it. Anyway, yeah, small as my show is in the grand scheme of things, being able to give a platform to passionate podcasters like Alec is really a perk of the position I'm in now after doing this for 10 years. Perhaps in 10 years' time, Alec will be invading Silesia himself under Frederick the Great's banner. But until then, make sure you check out his show, which comes highly recommended. Thanks to Alec for joining me. And I hope you enjoy this conversation, but what can you expect? Well, we talk about, of course, the actual time period, so say late 1740 to early 1741. We place the conflict that basically brought Frederick the Great into new heights of power and fame. We put that conflict into context, and we also talk about a few other random things as well. Frederick's military accomplishments, the political context of his invasion, what was going on in Austria at the time, why Frederick believed it was the perfect opportunity to strike, how the Holy Roman Empire compares with the European Union, whether the Habsburgs could have taken some lessons from House of the Dragon, and many more topics besides. It was a real fun conversation, and if you are a history podcaster and you would like to join me on this show to talk about things you're interested in too, then don't hesitate to reach out. Now, it might take me a while to reach back out to you because, well, you know, PhD and all that, but I'll do my best, and I'm really happy I did join Alec for this conversation, because that's what this medium is all about, connecting with other history nerds like you listening right now, and just shooting the breeze on fascinating history. So thanks to Alec for joining me, and of course thanks to you for supporting or listening to this show. It really means a lot, and I really, really appreciate it. Alrighty, the next voices you hear will be mine and Frederick the Great's. No, I'm joking. The next voices you hear will be mine and Alec's.
All right. So, how are things going, Zach?
Things are going great, Alec. Thank you so much for having me on, or me having you on, or whatever way you put it, because we're both appearing on each other's feeds. So this is going to be great. So today we're going to talk about the invasion of Silesia in December 1740 by Frederick the Great. Before he was great, he was just Frederick, and I suppose had a lot of ambitions and was a bit obsessed with glory.
How much does your audience know about the structure of the Holy Roman Empire?
Oh, what a question. Well, I'll save you Voltaire's famous quote of not being wholly an empire or really Roman at all. I suppose I just kind of brought it in there anyway. But we have gone through it a good bit with the 30 Years' War, so we have the kind of broad spectrum. But obviously, by 1740, things had changed a little bit. There were more electors floating around, and you could argue between Saxony going for the Polish crown and Prussia trying to be a kingdom all of its own, and then you have Hanover as well, also being ruled by the British. It's almost like everyone's trying to take a piece of the pie or make their own way in the world while still being in the Holy Roman Empire. So it's a very interesting time of change.
I actually like to make the analogy by that point. Essentially, they're all independent states united in very huge air quotes around one emperor. I like to make the analogy that essentially all the United States, if they're all independent, and the president was just the figurehead, and sometimes the states would follow the lead of the president, and other times they don't. Such as the one time where in the Holy Roman Empire, Bavaria chose to side with France against the Holy Roman Empire in the War of Spanish Succession.
Absolutely, yeah. And the interesting thing about that was that it seems as though the Allies didn't quite expect that to happen. In the initial years of the War of the Spanish Succession, Bavaria was a real pain for the Allied war plans, and it kind of soaked up a lot of attention and basically helped the French kind of reinforce their border areas, really.
Yeah, that's very true. I'd like to think that the Holy Roman Empire was just—it was more so just a confederation of states. So you can make somewhat of an argument that it's similar to how the EU is today, but I'm sure you know much more about that than I do, considering
Unfortunately,
your country is in the European Union, and I'm just the bystander watching the dominoes fall. So.
Well, let's hope no more dominoes fall. The whole Brexit situation is bad enough.
Oh my goodness.
And yeah, I mean, European unity is something I do believe quite strongly, and I think the argument for it is definitely strong, especially when you look at what's happening with Russia invading Ukraine and all that jazz.
Oh
But
yeah.
certainly the parallels are very interesting. So you'd have the EU Commission president would probably be the closest thing to the Holy Roman Emperor. But of course, there is a lot kind of a lot of independent initiatives and independent policy going on outside of what the EU is kind of dictating. I mean, a great example of that is France and Emmanuel Macron, the French president, basically finding a way for France in the world while using the EU as a kind of pedestal. So I wonder if you could argue that some Holy Roman Empire states, while benefiting from the security and ties of the Holy Roman Empire, were also trying to kind of make their own way in the world. I mean, Bavaria is a good example of that.
Bavaria and definitely Saxony as well,
Yeah,
because
Saxony.
with the War of Polish Succession, there was Stanislaus Leszczynski, who was a member of the Polish nobility, going against a Saxon. Both of those people were supported by different sides of Europe. And with France, with Stanislaus Leszczynski, and the Saxon claimant by Austria and Russia, and Prussia as well. Saxony could have been our Prussia, because if you think about it, say Saxony was the one who invades Silesia. Now you have Saxony connected with Poland, and they have this huge, massive super state where Prussia is completely blocked out. That is actually one of the reasons why Frederick the Great invaded Silesia. Silesia is this province that used to be a part of Bohemia, and Bohemia now in the Czech Republic, and Silesia would now be a part in what is today Poland. This area is extremely important to the Habsburg Empire. It has a bunch of linen industry. It was a quarter of Austria's tax revenue. And by the time Prussia overtook Silesia, it increased its population by 50%. So this is an extremely important province. Not only was Frederick looking at the economic perspective, but he was looking at possible rivals in the Holy Roman Empire. So it wasn't just about great power politics. It was middling power politics as well, because at this point, Prussia was not quite large enough to be a great power, but it wasn't small enough so that it was just the middling power in Europe. So,
yeah,
I would say that because Frederick the Great did invade Silesia, just transformed so many things, not only culturally, politically, economically. I would say that overall, my podcast is the context you could use for behind why the French Revolution occurred.
Yeah, and absolutely how the German states, basically, the question of German dualism, as they called, will Germany go towards Berlin or will it go towards Vienna? That question really starts to appear during this period. And you're right, having looked at this period from the kind of Polish perspective for my Poland Is Not Yet Lost series, it's really fascinating to ask what might have been, because these Saxon kings really had a chance to kind of change the course of German history and make the question more about should it be Dresden or Vienna rather than Berlin. It was strange, though, because I think Frederick might have been expecting a bit too much. He might have overestimated his Saxon neighbor, because especially after the War of the Polish Succession, it didn't seem like Augustus III, the Elector of Saxony and new King of Poland, it didn't seem like he was all that determined to do anything now that he'd gotten his Polish crown. And he seemed very happy to kind of just exist and use Polish resources and everything for the purposes of prestige, but not really increase his power all that much. And one thing that he was quite clear on was how much he owed his position to Russia. So in that sense, I think while on the map of Europe, a continuously connected landmass and statelet of Saxony and then Silesia and then Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth would have been extremely impressive. I'm not sure if Augustus III was really the right man to leverage those things, because he didn't really seem like he was all that interested in leveraging anything except the resources of his country to give himself a nice, comfortable, quiet life.
Oh, I mean, you could make that argument for almost all of the European states by the time that Frederick the Great came to power as king. In 1740, you had Louis the 15th, who, as a ruler, is not very impressive at all. You had King George the 2nd, who was just a puppet behind the Parliament of Great Britain. And you had Charles the 6th, who was one of the most, I would say, lethargic, because his court, I think on average, was about 70 years old as far as the average age of the court. And this was at a time when the life expectancy, I know for Britain, was 39 years old. And you have a whole bunch of 70-year-old men just talking about each other about, oh, what's the new wig of this season supposed to be like? whereas Prussia has the tradition that the sovereign is the first servant of the state. This goes all the way back to the great elector, who is extremely underrated in Prussian history. And what he was able to do to make what was then Brandenburg into a power that wasn't constantly stepped on is honestly fascinating, but sadly I don't have the time to go into that, because Frederick the Great is very much more famous.
Yeah, that's very true. It is interesting, though, in that sense, the Great Elector's kind of period of rule and Frederick the Great's period of rule almost exactly mirror each other by about 100 years. The Great Elector was from 1640 to, I think, 86, whereas, and you'll be able to correct me on this, Frederick the Great was 1740 to either 1780 or the late 80s. I'm not exactly sure which, but it is remarkable that they're so close like that.
40 to 1786, and that for Frederick the Great, and then the Great Elector was till 1640 to 1688. Because
oh, there we go.
Yeah, because I do remember that Frederick the Great ruled 46 years, which is, yeah, honestly, for that time, for the amount of battles that he was in, it's like the old the Bible quote, "Who lives by the sword dies by the sword." It's surprising that he did not die by the sword. If you consider how many battles he was in, how many horses were shot under him, my goodness.
Mm.
Going back to Charles VI, we have to go and understand the pragmatic sanction.
Sure.
Because this is one of the reasons why Frederick the Great had the casus belli, or the cause for war in the first place. Because the House of Habsburg was able to conquer a whole bunch of Europe, to oversimplify things completely, by marriage. They are able to bring up their status and wealth and power by marriage. And by the time they were the top of the European hierarchy, they decided, you know what? We don't want anybody else to do the same thing we did, so we're just going to intermarry between ourselves.
it's actually, I don't know if you're keeping up with the latest series, but House of the Dragon very much kind of, it's very reminiscent of that, because you have a powerful house in that case, the Targaryen dynasty, who are, again, very inbred, and they have been at the top of the food chain for quite a while, in that case in Westeros. And there is also a succession crisis where the daughter of the ruling king is declared as the heir, and it's never been done before, and it's hugely controversial. And the only difference really is that in House of the Dragon, there's kind of stronger claimants that are male to the throne, whereas in our real life, which seems strange that this stuff all actually happened, but in our real life, there aren't that many strong claimants other than, you know, I married her sister and that's how I'm going to claim. You know, it is interesting though to see those things. I wonder where George R. R. Martin got his inspiration from. He doesn't have to look all that far into history.
Oh no, not at all. But you sufficed it quite well as far as talking about the House of Dragon. It almost parallels perfectly to our timeline in actual history. In the Pragmatic Sanction, it was the idea that Charles VI of Austria's daughter, or any children that he would be able to have, would be able to inherit the throne of the Holy Roman Empire. There were other claimants, such as Bavaria. Bavaria's Charles Albert believed that he could take over the Holy Roman Empire, and he actually would, in our timeline, create that only time where the Habsburgs were not the emperors from the 1400s all the way until the end in 1806. So
yeah,
Bavaria was able to create the claim that Charles Albert deserved to be the Holy Roman Empire emperor.
Yeah, and interestingly, it's the Wittelsbach dynasty again. I believe it was 1400 to 1410 that they'd held the crown before, and basically from 1438 the Habsburgs had it in their back pocket and wouldn't let it go. So it kind of, it does paint a picture of how dicey the Habsburg position was, that this legacy had been taken from them for the first time in 300 years.
Austria had shown that it was very weak.
Mm-hmm.
So Prince Eugene of Savoy, a very huge and important figure in Austrian history, was able to help the Austrian military show that it had power, until he slowly got older, and through that time he actually had dementia. And when a state bases a military, or state function on the individual, it will go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because characteristics of that individual will slowly decline as they age and eventually die off.
Sure.
You would see the same thing after Frederick the Great died. State institutions that were united around Frederick the Great and his work ethic and his logistical nitpicking, it would eventually decay. And so in 1806, by the time Napoleon invaded Prussia,
mm-hmm.
it was a shell of the Prussian army was a shell of its former self.
Yeah, and that's only 20 years after he died. Like, it's crazy.
Charles VI was 55 years old, and he was going into his reign just believing that, okay, we just lost to the Turks. I don't think things can get much worse from here, so I'm going to go on a hunting trip just to clear things up in my mind. So he goes on this hunting trip in Hungary. This is the most incredible story that I've gotten from the 1700s. During a dinner, he had this bowl of mushrooms. And because of this bowl of mushrooms, history would change forever. Because he had food poisoning. He would eventually die later that month. And his daughter, Maria Theresa, would become the heiress of the Austrian Habsburg royal family. Charles VI believed that there was no way that Maria Theresa was actually going to rule. He expected that her husband would rule through proxy, and so he never spent the time to educate Maria Theresa in ways to rule. So you have a very young, very inexperienced Maria Theresa on the throne of the Habsburg Empire, while everybody in Central Europe was just looking at the Habsburgs with drool on their lips, thinking, okay, what territory can we get from this lady? And the first one to strike, obviously, was Frederick the Great. He wrote to his chief minister, "When one is a favorable situation, should one make use of it or not? If the Habsburgs are in such a weak position, and its allies, Britain and Russia, are off distracted on their own, and there's nothing else that could stop me, why don't I take that opportunity?"
It's a very famous example, Maria Theresa coming to the throne and people perceiving her as weak, but it's by no means the only time that this happened. I mean, you mentioned the Great Northern War a few times, but one of the main reasons that that war came into being was because in this case, Augustus II of Saxony, Poland, you had the Russian Tsar, and then you also had the Danes all tried to attack Sweden because Charles XII was 17 or 18 years old, and they perceived him as a young, weak, inexperienced king. So this tendency of equating the power of the state with the inexperience or experience of the new monarch is quite a surprisingly common trend and has led to war in the past. So, I mean, in the end of the Northern War, I suppose you could argue Sweden's enemies were victorious. So maybe from that, even though it took 21 years, maybe from that they took heart and thought that, hey, maybe we can make lightning strike twice. So we've talked a good bit about 1740 itself and the kind of context of the period. Maybe run us through what you think would be going through Maria Theresa's mind when, having been assured by Frederick himself, no less, that they were going to uphold the Pragmatic Sanction, that in fact a Prussian army is invading one of your richest provinces and intends to take it away.
Silesia itself was guarded by a very small Austrian army. I'm pretty sure it was around 2,000 infantry, 1,000 cavalry, and a total of 3,000 men. Maria Theresa was like, "Well, we're screwed," and the Austrian court was like, "Okay, we can just give up Silesia," and Maria Theresa said no. Almost all of her court said that there's no way that we could defeat this strong army, especially with how our resources are spread completely thin. The Habsburg monarchy was had just lost the war with the Turks and did not have very many reliable troops to count upon. But Maria Theresa was able to go to Hungary and ask for the Hungarians to mobilize different, I think around, she asked for 40,000 troops, and she only received about 20,000. However, she was able to piece through a bunch of different soldiers throughout her empire and bring an army of around 40,000 into what is now the Czech Republic, into what was then Bohemia. And in the winter of 1740, Frederick was able to go and take over Silesia in a very quick lightning strike, was able to occupy almost the entire territory in about a month, when armies were moving much slower than Frederick the Great's army at that time. One thing that one aspect that is often overlooked is logistics, just in history in general.
Oh yeah, because definitely.
All of Frederick the Great's advisors were really against the invasion in general, was because he was going to invade Silesia in the winter.
Yeah, the winter.
It goes against all of the ideas of war at the time that we should not go to war in the winter. We should just focus on our ability to just make it through, and then we can work on the military in the spring. But Frederick said, "When will we have this possibility ever again?" He said specifically in a quote, "If one does not advance, one retreats." And so he took that principle and he put it on Silesia. And with that, he was able to invade and conquer Silesia in about a month.
So, yeah, it wasn't just politically unexpected for the Austrians. They might have had some kind of idea he was planning something, but having assured them that he would abide by the terms, at the very least, they might have thought, I mean, it's the winter, so even if he does attack us, it's not going to be now. It'll be in the spring or in the summer during the campaigning season. So either way, we have a bit of a breather to have our army repaired and kind of plan for the next few months. But then, bam, out of nowhere, not just against all the political agreements, but all the kind of the expectations and norms of the day, we would have thought it would be a complete logistical nightmare to try and invade anywhere in Europe. I mean, that part of Europe during the winter, like, you can expect to find a good deal of snow, as of course they did.
Oh yeah. Now, if you want to even take this a step further and look around the entire huge scope of climate back in the day, this was during the Little Ice Age as well. So with global warming happening today, we don't necessarily know the full feel of the full scale of the winter at that time. So even though we do have poor winters now, as far as snow and things go like that, it was worse back in those days.
Yeah,
it was a lot worse.
Frederick had to face the elements, and he also had to move his father's shiny army down south and make this daring attack, probably on the understanding that once he invaded, he wouldn't have to fight an actual pivotal battle for a few months. So in that sense, it might have been like more recommended, not just the element of surprise, but also tactically, he could take this province that isn't very well defended, and he wouldn't actually have to face an Austrian army until the Austrians pick their jaws off the floor and find some kind of way to send an army north. So in that sense, it does seem like a good tactical decision, but I'm sure Maria Theresa was very depressed when she found out.
Oh, not just depressed. She was mad with the fury of vengeance. I think that it goes back to the idea that Frederick actually didn't think he was going to fight at all. He just thought he was going to strong arm the Austrians into saying, oh yeah, we surrender. Here's Silesia for you. You can take the keys whenever you want. It's yours. He went back to Berlin after the December campaign and let his generals on the ground deal with the different forts and strong points that were left. So he fully expected that the diplomatic work to begin at that point, and Silesia would just be something that he could have now. Obviously, that did not occur, because Maria Theresa has revenge in her eyes. And it goes all the way to through the First Silesian War. Maria Theresa eventually creates a peace with Frederick because she was being invaded by the French and Bavarians and the Saxons all at once. There were multiple battles that were key to Frederick staying in Silesia. And the first battle that Frederick fights is the Battle of Mollwitz. This was during the May of 1741. The Austrian Field Marshal Neipperg was in Bohemia bringing troops and eventually counter-invaded Silesia to take back the former Austrian province. Now, in Mollwitz, when the two armies finally met up, Frederick did not have his best general with him. Sure, he had a Field Marshal Schwerin, but he left the famous Prince Leopold of Anhalt-Dessau behind him, named the Old Dessauer. Frederick the Great believed that he didn't want to have tutors with him. He wanted to prove his own mettle.
Didn't exactly go. I mean, to spoil, I mean, your listeners obviously know what happens next, but for the sake of my own, I mean, in terms of your first ever battle, it didn't exactly go how Frederick was expecting.
Oh my goodness, no. The Prussian army deployed very slowly, very, very much so by the books. They created their battle line in the snow, and they marched forward slowly, and then they just stood there. But the Austrians, their cavalry, one of the best cavalries in Europe, mind you, they decided, all right, the Prussians are about to attack us, let's attack them first. The Austrian cavalry charged and charged and charged, and the Prussians did nothing. The Prussian cavalry did nothing. Frederick actually had to flee the battle because it looked like he was going to lose, and he did not want to be captured and become this puppet king where he was in Austrian captivity. During this time, it was clear to Field Marshal Schwerin that all he needed to do was just reform the infantry, bring back confidence to the men, and go on a big sweeping counter offensive against the Austrian lines. And that's exactly what happened. So Frederick the Great won his first battle without actually being there.
Yeah, it's an interesting asterisk next to his first victory that it wasn't even from like his own prowess. It was more from his subordinates. I often find with these great men in history, I mean, they're famous and deservedly so, but like with Louis XIV, they're very fortunate to have some very capable people around them. And Frederick was certainly no exception to that. He had fantastic generals, like you said, and if the soldiers had lost heart by seeing their king fleeing the field, I mean, it could have all been lost had like stability and morale not been restored. But I suppose that's the kind of consequences of so many years of good quality drilling and good education in tactics and in forbearance that his infantry basically won the day, whereas it looked for a time like the Austrian cavalry might win the day.
Prussian musketry was very important. I do have an episode about that, two episodes about the Prussian infantry. If one soldier turns and flees, that might cause other soldiers in that very platoon to leave as well and flee, because with linear warfare you have very bunched up lines in order to create a mass fire, but you also have the trouble is if discipline breaks in any single way, you're looking on a rout. And oftentimes after the battle, when the cavalry was prowling against the enemy, That's when the most deaths and casualties occurred.
Absolutely, yeah. The real strength of these units and the regiments that are standing there static, we imagine them stoically watching their friends fall, they knew in their hearts that if they shattered and fled, they were as good as dead. The strength of those units are in their cohesion and their discipline. And that's something that I really kind of learned from the 1600s and really the 1500s as well, those periods of so-called military revolutions. It became less about the skill of the individual soldier and more about the fighting prowess of the unit itself. And if nothing else, the firepower of one musketeer is much less than the coordinated firepower drills of several men lined up in rows. So that explains, we might look at those formations and wonder why they were kind of lined up like that, or how they could see their friends get killed in such large numbers. And of course, people did rout, but there was this understanding, having drilled together, that the real strength of the unit was in its ability to stick together.
I had a professor who was a German culture professor, who was very interested in a time period that we're talking about. And he said that Frederick the Great treated his army like a machine. He had replaceable bits and pieces throughout the army, that if one bit of the army was taken away or destroyed, it could be replaced.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's not a very kind of romantic way of looking at things, but we might put a kind of a mask of glory on these events, on these battles and stuff. But the reality is, this conflict happened because of the will pretty much of one man. And while his soldiers might have had an attachment to him later on in his reign, it really was all about him. And the army was an instrument for him. It wasn't a group of people that he cared deeply about, because, of course, if he did, they wouldn't be anywhere near this place risking their lives for his glory.
Ironically, the weird thing is that he somewhat seemed to care about the individual soldiers, in that if his soldiers were fit and the best in the world, then he would have the best army in the world. But
sure,
he slightly cared about them individually, in that he was able to give really good eulogies later on in his life. He was able to remember names, remember the faces of the people individually, ironically give good speeches about them after they had passed away. But it took very many Prussian lives and deaths in order for him to be able to seek his glory, as it were.
Yeah, it's the old adage of how many lives is one man's glory worth. It kind of all comes back to that. But I mean, obviously, there was nothing exceptional about this way of looking at things. There's no real use in casting Frederick as some kind of heartless fiend who was unusual for his time. He was really just continuing on this trend of seeking glory for glory's sake, and of course also strategic and financial reasons as well, bolstering the realm of Prussia, which would in turn bolster his own honor and prestige.
The search for glory, that was the one thing he was looking for.
Yeah.
He was a neoclassicist, so he had read books from Sophocles to Plutarch to all these different classical writers, and he firmly believed that he was reliving the glory days of Rome. When he invaded Silesia, he alluded to that by saying, "I have crossed the Rubicon with flags flying and drums beating."
Yeah, the long, long shadow of Rome over this period of time is really quite fascinating. I mean, I know you get some people these days who are pretty obsessed with Rome, understandably, but it is incredible to think that 1700 years after Rome, well, I suppose 1300 or 1400 after Rome had actually fell, but the level of influence that was carried down to that point is really incredible. Like, just for those that might not be aware, the actual process of standing still with your lines of infantry and firing, and then wheeling to the back of the line in a process called a countermarch while the other people in your line fire, that was based on Roman tactics as well. That was built from the Dutch basically researching and looking through old ancient records for inspiration, and getting this idea that if they could stand there like Roman soldiers did, with their throwing their javelins and then wheeling to the back of the line. If they could do that with muskets, then they would be able to redefine warfare. And it was bloody and it was difficult. And the first time that was actually done was in the year 1600. And during a battle there between the Spanish and the Dutch, the whole practice was arguably kind of born. And then it grew from there through military drill manuals to the point where we have in the 1740s. But really, the debt that these people owed to Rome is really incredible.
Oh, I 100% agree. And the debts that I owe to the History of Rome podcast is also important too.
Oh yeah.
Without Mike Duncan's History of Rome, I don't think many of us would be podcasting right now. So.
No, certainly not. No, his contributions are certainly up there. You really can't deny them. I think History of England too, just because for me as a non-American person, hearing an American voice, I mean, it's something that I'm kind of not necessarily familiar with, but I'm like, oh yeah, it's an American podcast, or he's American making a podcast. But when I heard an English guy as an Irish person, I was like, oh, well, if the freaking English can do it, then why can't I do it? So that drove me on.
I bet, yeah. So Frederick the Great was able to defeat the Austrians in two battles, Mollwitz and Chotusitz. And at Chotusitz, the Austrians could have been defeated more according to Frederick the Great, but he chose not to pursue that victory to its entirety because he could show Maria Theresa that he was a man that she could work with.
Right.
And by that point in time, Vienna had almost been taken multiple times, either by Frederick or by the French and Bavarian army that we haven't actually talked about. But France and Bavaria and Saxony all went to war against Austria with Prussia in 1742. Now, after Austria lost to the Prussians, they are in such a weakened state that it was time for Austria to make peace with Prussia. And
yeah.
So that's what happened in June of 1742. And that is where I shall leave you at.
Well, there is certainly a lot of juicy diplomacy to come. So if you wish to see what this action would have looked like, you will have to tune in to Alex's podcast, The History of Frederick the Great, or Frederick the Great's Life and Times.